Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williams and Mike Cosentino sitting across from me. And today we have another person, not a corporation, in the studio with us. Lane Kinworthy, he's a professor of sociology, political science down at the University of Arizona. He's written a whole series of books and has a wonderful blog called Consider the Evidence. So when you're talking to Lane, we're talking to somebody who does a lot of research. His research has been cited by major figures like Paul Krugman and the Times Economic Blog. And he's someone that does a lot of comparative studies and so forth and so on. So we're really glad to have you in the studio today, Lane.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Yes, you warm the hearts of many liberals and but your writing and your topics are provocative. We just came from a talk where when we heard things like America has a big government future. And in listening to your material and in reading your material, it makes so much sense. So
it's a provocative title, even
exactly.
For Democrats, because and what we're seeing is a wave of hatred of government and a denial of what government does well. It's not that their programs don't have to be, we see a denial of what government does well. So, Lane, tell us a little bit about your research.
Including the comparison to the other governments as far as the size of our government. America's government is perceived as being bloated. Maybe not so.
Does America have a big government compared to wealthy countries?
No, it doesn't. Of course, there are a variety of ways to measure the size of government, but one very common and I think pretty useful measure is the amount that the government spends in a given year as a share or a percentage of the size of the economy, usually measured by gross domestic product or what we call GDP. So government spending is a share of GDP. In the U.S., before the recession started, so in 2007, the last year of the good economic period before things fell apart, we spent around 37%. So roughly speaking, about a third of our GDP goes through the government. Most other rich countries, if we think about the 20 or so rich, long-standing democratic nations in the world, spend more than that. Not all of them, but most spend more. And the top spenders spend around 50% or so of GDP. And that's not just a blip for the particular year. That's a sort of long-run averages for other wealthy nations around the world.
So are attitudes different, say, in Sweden and Denmark that spend a lot on social programs than they are in the U.S.? I mean, how did Denmark and Sweden go one way and we've stayed another? Is it values? Is it economic experience?
Well, that's a common notion. So we tend to think that democracies get, in terms of their policies, they get more or less what their citizens want. So public opinion really drives what policymakers decide to do. And we know from public opinion data, looking across these countries, that, for example, in Denmark and Sweden, a much larger share of the population thinks that luck is an important determinant of where you end up in life, whereas Americans are much more likely to say it comes down to individual effort. So from that, you can infer that Americans think there's less need for government to do things like promote economic opportunity and insure against misfortunes, you know, provide a generous safety net, and that therefore explains why we see these differences across the countries or between the countries in how big the government is. But what I would argue is that the causality probably runs more in the opposite direction, that Swedes weren't born or raised a century ago to be, let's say, egalitarians or folks who favor a large government, a generous welfare state, whereas Americans were born and raised to favor a small government. Instead, what's happened is that over time, and here we're talking about mostly over the last century, in some countries beginning a little bit before the 1930s, but in most countries in the 1930s, then after World War II, a good bit in the 1960s, and then kind of episodically in other decades, most countries have put in place a variety of programs, pension security, unemployment insurance, what's usually called social assistance to help the very poorest, and an array of others, not to mention schooling, health care, and so on. Some countries have put in place more than others.
Yeah, you talked about the opportunity side and then the safety net side. And as far as framing what government does, both here and abroad, that you just talk about some of the opportunity side things and then the safety net side things, and that those countries that spend a large percentage of their GDP have perfectly functioning governments and running countries that, and do provide safety net and opportunity.
What's the most important thing that government does to empower people and to create opportunity, do you think?
Well, for opportunity, I think it's schooling and education. And, of course, we spend a lot of money on schooling, most of which is government money, although there's a lot of private schooling money here in the United States, too. All countries do this. One area where we're, I think, I would say behind some other countries is in schooling before kindergarten. So we've thought for over a century now that what schooling means is that you start around age 6 and you finish around age 18, and then a certain share of the population will go on to get a college or beyond college type of degree. Many other countries, not all, but many other rich countries around the world now think of schooling as including years before age 6. So a lot of Americans are in child care, some are in preschool. In many other countries, they've come to think of this as a part of the schooling system. So what they want to do is try to ensure that people get some learning, some socialization, some improvement in their cognitive skills and their non-cognitive traits and abilities, whether it's discipline or hard work or cooperation or what have you, things that can contribute to your learning as you go through elementary, secondary school, college, and also to your success on the job market. They do this not entirely through the government, but partly through the government. I think this is one of the areas where we are likely to, at least I'd like to see us expand a government role in coming decades.
And then the safety net side, just for clarity, let's go ahead and mention some of those.
Right, yeah. So safety net side mainly means providing insurance against various types of misfortune and also life course events. So periods when we're not able to provide our living standards through earnings in the labor market. That means retirement security, unemployment insurance, and again, an array of other types of programs, some of which we have but don't necessarily work as well as they could. They're kind of porous. A lot of people fall through the cracks, and some of which we don't have at all.
Let me throw you a curve. One of the things, you've used the term America as a rich country. And I think Americans bristle at that. How could a rich country have so much misery and poverty and need?
Well, that's a relative term, of course. So there are about 193 countries in the world. 20 of them are really rich, and there are some other nations that have joined the pack. But we really do have economies that are much larger relative to our population than almost all of the rest of the world. And you can see it. Let me just mention, you can see a very clear pattern. This comes back to the notion of security and the safety net and the way that government has a prominent role in providing insurance against all kinds of risks that we face and life course events. You can see a very clear pattern across countries. As they get richer, as their economies grow larger and larger, people are more willing to pay for more insurance. You see this among individuals within a society, too. People who have higher incomes spend more of it on insurance because they can afford to and they want to insure against loss. So we see that for societies, too, and I expect that'll continue.
So Social Security and Medicare are basically insurance programs.
Absolutely. That's what they are. They're insurance against health care misfortune and insurance against living longer than you can work.
One of the misery,
which would be a good thing.
The other really provocative thing that I liked was wage insurance and how that applies to workers. You talked about how so many people identify themselves as working class. If you ask somebody to identify themselves, they'll identify themselves as working class or middle class, if that's the choice. But tell us a little bit about what wage insurance is. We don't hear much about that.
We don't hear a lot about
wage insurance. From our government, anyway.
What would that mean?
Well, so we have a program that will provide, we call it unemployment insurance or unemployment compensation. It'll provide money to you if you've been working long enough and earned enough so that you qualify for
we
it,
have
which,
that.
Which a lot of people don't.
Yes.
Right. We have that.
Yeah.
That provides money if you lose your job temporarily. Usually you can get it up to 6 months, and normally in recessions the government will extend it for a while like it has recently. But it's increasingly common, and I think it will get even more common into the future, for people to switch jobs many times during their life course, sometimes by choice, often because they're laid off. You know, the economy goes sour, or the firm they work for moves its factory to China or to northern Mexico, or there's new technology that puts them out of work, and so they have to find a new job. In the American labor market, when we're not in the midst of a bad recession or just coming out of a bad recession, a lot of people find jobs fairly quickly, but many of them don't get paid the same as their previous job. And that's to be expected. It's an unfortunate reality of the new economy. Well, we could create an insurance program.
Who's an auto worker is not going to find a job if he's laid off paying anything like that. He's going to end up working in the service industry or whatever.
That's right.
And that's happening all over the country, right? And it's a massive thing of people basically either working less hours or they're working for much lower pay because the higher paying jobs have sort of disappeared for a part of the spectrum of people working, haven't they?
That's right. And it's not just a function of the recession. That's been steadily growing for several decades as we've been losing manufacturing jobs, for example.
So how would it help me? I'm an auto worker. I'm making 20, 30 bucks an hour. I get laid off. And I take a job for $10 an hour. Selling radio advertising.
Right. Well, the program could be structured in various ways, but the basic idea is to cover some of that resulting gap in your earnings, the amount that you've lost. See, we want people to move quickly back into the labor force. That's what helps the economy work well. And it's good for them, too, to not be stuck out of the labor force for a long time where their skills might deteriorate and they start to look less and less attractive to employers.
It's really demoralizing for people to be unemployed, and people really don't like it.
Well,
it's fine for a few, couple of 3 weeks, and then you begin, you know, feeling really sort of creepy about the whole thing.
As you kind of alluded to, there's something demoralizing, you know, especially for men of a certain age or women of a certain age, that to go backwards. So we believe that when we go on to another job, our salaries, our income will increase. That's not
really not what happening, is it, Mike?
Right.
Right. It certainly doesn't happen as often as we like. And I think this type of scenario where someone's job options, when they get laid off, if they want to get back in quickly, mean taking a pay cut or salary cut or fewer hours or some combination of those. So wage insurance is simply an idea to fill in that gap, to cover that particular kind of risk in order to help our labor market continue to be adaptive and encourage people to continue to go back into work quickly.
One of the things I want to mention, of course, is this discussion will be on BVID.org. You can listen to this and more there, obviously. I mean, we're going to come back and talk to Mr. Kenworthy more. A lot more. We have another show with him. But
podcasts of our early interviews with Lane done a couple of months ago are available on the website.
We're going to talk about. I want to talk about wage stagnation next time.
Okay. Income stagnation it
is. Income. Why our incomes aren't going up. He's got the answers.
VVID.org. Drop by the website. And all our podcasts of all our shows are available. Well, thanks very much for joining us today. We want to thank Lane for coming all the way up here from
Tucson. Let me get his name right. Lane Kenworthy. All right.
Okay. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.